station number 11210, reel 4.
Mr. A.H. Watcham, Reel 4. Can you describe to me, Mr. Watcham, the German discipline in the camp, the way in which the Germans disciplined the prisoners?
Well, as I said before, we had a hauptmann, a captain, and non-commissioned officers, and I think there would be about 20 or 30 guards. They lived outside the camp. They did a perimeter march to keep us, you know, keep an eye on us. But they didn't bother us in the camp at all, very, very rarely. And they purely and simply took us to work and came back. And by and large, they were very reasonable with us, as long as we didn't misbehave. There were instances when people did misbehave. And they were punished accordingly.
And was it always a cooler punishment, or were there other types of punishment?
There were other types of punishment. On one occasion, and I was if you call it, a victim of this, but we once went on strike, which is unheard of in Germany, I mean, in a prison camp. But we thought we were working what they call Pensumarbeit, that was sort of a piece work, and we felt that it was too much for us, and we downed tools. And it was a complete waste of time because they just stood and waited, and then they sent for guards from the camp. We had to finish the work, and then we were marched back to the camp, and instead of dispersing to shower and get something to eat, we were stood on the camp square facing the sun, and as the sun went round, we went round, and we stood there quite some time till the sun went down. Nothing to eat. And then we were allowed to go back into our barracks.
What effects did that have?
Well, we certainly didn't go on strike again.
Because you'll be looking into the sun, is that the thing?
Yes, that was the sort of thing they did.
Did anyone suffer particularly from
not,
that?
Not really. This was, fortunately, you know, late-ish in the evening. But that was the sort of thing they did to us. There were occasions when you would get a rifle butt or something like that, but in my experience, that wasn't commonplace. In fact, later, sometimes you got a bond between the guards and yourselves, especially when we were doing this Pensumarbeit. Since ever we'd done our quota, we could go back to camp. So obviously this was a carrot, really. The better you worked, the harder you worked, the quicker you got back to camp. And this was good for us on the recreation side. And of course, it gave the German guards a little more free time. So, you know, we worked together like that. But there was no close fraternizing, or very, very little. No, they knew their job and we knew what we were.
There was no interchange of gifts of any kind between them?
No, no. We were... It's funny too, you would sort out the guards. You soon got to know who were good and who were bad, and you know, you reacted accordingly. But we, as I say, we worked 14 hours a day. We didn't have time to think much about this. Then, of course, when we got established and we were allocated to contractors, we started building railways by this time. And we would get a certain stretch to do, and we started felling timber. Oh, I'm an expert at felling timber, drawing roots out of the ground. And it was all done by hand, very, very hard labour. There were no machines to help us.
There was no attempt to build what you were building badly, was there?
Oh, yeah. There were little acts of sabotage. One of the jobs we had to do was to fill these skips with sand. It was terrible work. And I remember I got an Irishman from Northern Ireland with me. He was a Jew, actually, Paddy Kyle. And he and I were the two worst workers on the column, and we were always in trouble because we were never finished in time. And the 20 or 30 men on the column would have to fill so many skips. And then this little engine would shove it up. What they did there was to fill the defiles in and cut through the cuttings. You know, you understand what I mean? And, of course, we'd learned a bit of German by then, and the man at the front had to shout "Noch a bisschen," and that meant a little bit more. And of course, we knew it was getting too far over, and the whole lot would go and delay the job. And that was when we got roused around a little bit.
Just didn't know that you were doing it on purpose.
Oh yes, because we knew what we were doing. You see, there were little sabotage acts like that, but nothing of a major, you know. Well, we weren't trained in anything like that. What you did, for example, this same paddy, we had to shovel the mutter boden away. That's the 2 or 3 inches of soil, you know, in the North German plain. It's all sand, and you had to push this back, dig the sand out, and then put the soil back so that they could grass it. And he covered his jacket up one day in a great pile of earth. And he was in dire trouble because that was an act of sabotage. This was, yeah, we were positively amazed that Germans would call that an act of sabotage. Poor old Paddy was in trouble over it, of course. But there were no deliberate attempts.
Was there anyone injured or even killed in this work?
No. Nobody killed, but there were quite a lot of injuries. Rupture was one of the worst things. And some of our own men were as guilty for that. You know, a truck would come off the road. In fact, it happened to my own friend. And you always had to lift it back on. As I said, there were no cranes, I think. And 6 or 8 Tommies would get round this truck to lift and, you know, shout "Hey up!" And only one man lifted. And that was a rupture.
And what was the medical help like in the camp?
We had a doctor in the camp.
Was he German or...?
No, he was a New Zealander, actually. But there again...
What were the facilities like?
Well, there was a little sick bay, quite all right, but the dispensing of pills was the most obvious thing. I went sick once or twice, but you were always under threat from the commandant. If he thought you were fit to work, you went to work. I had some terrible bites, mosquito bites, which festered. But I had to go to work. They weren't bad, and I could hardly walk. But that was the side we objected to mostly.
And the worst medical cases, did they go outside?
They went back to the Stalag. There was a military-type hospital.
This was
there,
the original?
Where we were to begin with, yeah. If it was a real serious case, yes. There's a story I can tell you in the next camp to do with that.
You were working, you say, long hours.
Yes.
Was there any form of pay? Were you paid for
this? We were paid, I understand. We didn't learn about this later. We were paid about 15 pfennigs an hour, I think. And we even had off-takes, because I understood we had to pay for our own electricity and all that. And we were paid in what they call Lagergeld. It's camp money. It wasn't worth the pay. We used to play cards for thousands of marks. It was great fun, because it was no use to us.
You couldn't buy anything in the camp?
Well, there was supposed to be a canteen, but the canteen was practically worthless. There was nothing in it. We had a Sergeant Isaacs, I remember he was in charge of it. One of his jobs, of course, he was our camp informer. If there was a search, if the guards had organised searches, which they did from time to time, or Gestapo came, he used to hang a pair of trousers on them. You know, we had all this secret signalling, and we were warned. Because by this time, we had started the barter system, you see, Red Cross had come through, and some men had 2 pairs of underpants. And it was quite strange to go through the town sometimes and see a pair of WD pants hanging on the line. Obviously somebody done a swap. You know, you can get half a dozen eggs, probably. And the Polish women would undo a pullover, for example, and knit it up for something else. You could get a piece of...
Can we talk a bit more about the barter system, since we've mentioned the payment anyway?
Yeah.
You mentioned the kind of things that were bartered. What other things were bartered?
We would take Red Cross out, maybe. I didn't like cocoa, for example, so I would take cocoa with me. You took a chance if you were
searched. When you went out to work?
When you went... Well, that was the only contact you had, you see. And... we worked with a firm who'd have a Schachmeister, an Obermeister, or sort of a foreman, you see. Now, you soon gathered whether he was willing or not, if he was a diehard Nazi or a diehard, you know, you just ignored him. Then many of the undermen were Polish or Volksdeutsch. And each column, you see, the camp had a camp commandant, an English one, who was a sergeant. And then each column, maybe of 20 men or 30 men, would have an NCO with them. And he didn't work. Anybody who had the rank of corporal didn't work, incidentally. So, I've never seen as many corporals and sergeants grow overnight. There again, be a student, I had the sense to put three stripes up, but never mind. This man marched at the head of the column, and he was responsible for discipline within the column, which, you know, didn't amount to anything, because we went to work and came back. But he looked after us, and very often he was the one that did the liaison. You know, he would ask anybody, you know, what have you got with you today? And say, oh, I've got 10 cigarettes, because cigarettes were worth their weight in gold. You could get anything almost from a tank to a fog of wool for a pack of the cigarettes. It became the currency. But most of us took out what we didn't want out of our Red Cross parcels, and we would leave it in a certain place and then go back, and there you would find a dozen eggs or a bag of flour or something, or bacon, that sort of thing, or even bread. And how do we get them back into the camp? Well, you see, we had these stoves in the camp, these in the middle, so they didn't supply us with coal. So this sergeant or corporal, whoever he was, would collect wood during the time we were working and bundled up almost like a witch's broom. And inside, we stowed away all sorts, and marched back to camp. And then we were counted, and 9 times out of 10, they would just dismiss us. If you were searched, it was just tough. If we got wind there was a search, we used to dump stuff all the way down. And it was quite... I remember one... can I give a little anecdote like this? Because this sergeant had been in the First World War, and he'd had a terrible injury. A bullet had ricocheted and really ripped his leg, and he walked with a tremendous limp. And he was in charge of this column. And they were taken to work on a lorry, because we were a long way off. And he asked permission, could he have a stool to sit on? And he built this stool with a false bottom. And for weeks he went out, and this thing was absolutely stacked full of merchandise. And he got away with it for a long time. And on one occasion, when they got off the lorry, they had to line up to be counted, of course. And the Germans could only count in threes, couldn't count in fours, at least we didn't think so. And this young lieutenant, who was a new fellow, came out to have a look at us and check on these. And as he walked back, he stumbled against this stool. And instead of the stool falling over, he fell. God, suspicious straight away, you see. Smashed it open. My goodness to me, they were pandemonium. Needless to say, the poor old sergeant walked to work the next day without this. But that was the sort of thing, we smuggled things in. And by and large, we got away with it.
And was the barter system used within the camp itself as well?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I've never smoked in my life, so cigarettes were valuable to me. I remember the first Red Cross we got. Because we were a long time before Red Cross got through.
Any idea when the first Red Cross arrived?
Oh, it wasn't till almost to Christmas. It was a long time in coming. And when we got the parcel, there was only one parcel per hut. It was just a filter that came through. So we had to lay the goods out, and there were excellent parcels. There was chocolate and tins of bully beef, a packet of tea, butter, you know, you name it. We laid them all out and got the cards out, put the cards down. And I'm a great card player. I still play bridge and whist today. And every time I see the aces plays, I wince, because that was the card I drew. And you'll never guess what I won. You know these little stubs of salt that you get in packets of crisps? That's what I got. And I'm not ashamed to say it. I went in the corner and I wept silently. You know, when you're hungry, these things happen. You know, there's a difference between a tin of Spam or bully beef and a packet of salt. I was really upset, but of course it was a chance I took. And there's always a wag somewhere, always a wit. Chap came at me and said, never mind, Alan, he says, you can always put that on your potatoes. But it was very disappointing. But after that, Red Cross came fairly regularly. And I always give a donation to the Red Cross now, because there's no doubt about it, without Red Cross, we would never have gone out as well as we did. Marvellous.
Can we talk a bit about the Red Cross? Yeah. They sent food parcels. In what other ways did they attempt to help you?
Well, again, I wrote through the Red Cross to the Bodleian Library. I got books sent out. We had all sorts of musical instruments sent out. I played soccer for England, I think I told you before. I'm really proud of it. I've got a photograph there with the three line, rampant lines on. And we played, because this, again, there were a lot of Scotsmen taken in France and Irish and Welsh. And we played international matches. And funny enough, the Germans came and watched us, and they were very keen. Oh, it was really exciting. And then we started playing league football, because there was room, and it was hard-baked sand. It was the idea for football. And then we got all sorts of things sent, instruments. We ran concerts. One of my friends wrote the Desert Song from memory, wrote the whole music, words and everything. And I remember they came to me, I was in having a shower, and a chap came up to me and says, "You speak French, don't you?" I said, "Well, I'm Bill, you know, a schoolboy French. We're forming a drama group." He said, "Would you like to take part?" I said, "Yes." Weeks later, I got this part. And you know what? I was the native slave girl. And I was told to go to work and strip and get as brown as I could. And I wore two towels as a bra and a, you know, towel around my waist. And I took the part of the native. Natisha, is it the car? I can't remember. Fantastic, though. You know, 3 nights it ran. Germans in the first 4 or 5, I could fill a tape with the excitement. It was, of course, there again, it was, you see, this broke the monotony. And I took the part of Lieutenant Riley in, what was that, World War One book or play? Oh, near Journey's End. Great. And we had to use our own ingenuity. We used to barter with the poles for silk stockings, and we used to break open pencils and crush the graphite and dye things with them. You know, and we were fortunate. We had a very nice big recreation room.
What other forms of entertainment did you have? You've mentioned the football and the drama.
Yeah. Well, as I say, we broke off into little groups too. I was a bridge player then, and the camp doctor sent word round, was anybody played bridge? And the man who was batman for him was my closest friend. So I whiled many a weary hour away playing bridge.
Do you remember the doctor's name?
I don't. He was a New Zealander, a lovely fellow. He fought, unfortunately, was sent back. They changed people regularly, and we got a chap from Leeds. He wasn't a doctor, really. He was a pharmacist. But he hated the Germans, and he did everything possible to annoy them. In fact, in the end, they shipped him off, and we gave him a rousing send-off. Great. He was a great fellow, but not a very good doctor, unfortunately. We read a lot too, you see. By this time we were getting books through, and we also got parcels from home, which surprised us.
Was your family?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was sent for, and in this parcel were huge blocks of chocolate, which I made a pig of myself. You know, I've got a very sweet tooth, passionately fond of chocolate. I can't understand how it was got through. And incidentally, I don't know whether I can mention this, probably lead on to escapes, because in this parcel was a wind cheater, or what do you call an anorak today, brand new. And the Germans allowed me to have it. I was astonished, because it was civilian clothing. And I'd about 3 or 4 nights later, these two chaps came up to me and asked me, was I the one who had the wind cheater? I said, yes. They said, well, could they buy it off me? I said, well, you know, what for? They wanted to escape. I couldn't believe it.
Did you sell it?
No, I gave it to them. I said, I won't. I thought, so we'll give you underpants, socks, food. And I said, no way. If it's a genuine effort to escape, you can have it. And they took it off me. They said, well, write a letter to your mother, and if we get a will, I said, no way. So I refused to put anything to paper. I said, if you get back, you contact my regiment. This was our... we'd had one attempt to escape, which was an absolute disaster.
And how did that go?
The first escape? Well, they went... typical type of escape. They went over to the laundry, which was outside the camp, smuggled out, and we kept saying, what, 24 hours they'll be where? Oh... nearly up to Stettin by now, you know, 48 hours, or if they've gone the other way, they'll not be far off the Swiss border. 60 hours we gave them before it was discovered, you know, because we shuffled around with numbers. And they were 2 miles down the road, and I'm not telling you where they were. And that
right,
finished.
Where were they?
Well, they were in a Polish women's camp. You know, fair enough. But we were punished for it, you see. The punishment was the stop privileges, couldn't play football, this, that, and the other. They didn't physically punish them, but and that made us very chary about helping escapees after that.
Were there many attempts to escape?
Oh, there were many fiddling attempts. Where were you going to escape to? You couldn't go east. Stettin was the nearest place on the Baltic, but that was very, very heavily guarded, the way to Sweden. It was a heck of a long way to Switzerland, you know. So, and we had no contact, you see. And this is when I first started learning German. And I gave them this windshield, incidentally, but I would take nothing off them, you see. One of them said his wife was expecting a baby, and the other one was going to go with them, and this and the other. And it seemed, as far as I could see, a well organised attempt, you see. It'll do you know, of course. And prior to this, one of these old German guys, and he must have been 65, whether he looked upon me like a son or something, I don't know, but he had a son in the force, but he used to come to me and he asked me, did I play a football? It was very poor English, you know, football. Of course, football was my forte, you see, and he'd actually seen Aston Villa play in Berlin, you know, and this was the breakthrough. And he started teaching me German. And that was how I learned German. He would point to something, you know, Was ist das und das ist ein Baum, zwei Bäume. And I would go back at night to camp and wrote all this down in phonetics. And I built up a vocabulary. And that was how I learned German. And he came to me this day and said, mein Gott, der verrückte Engländer, the mad Englishman. He's doing escape. Well, if you've seen films of escapees, you wear a French beret and you wear this, you know, you look like a foreign worker. These two would walk down the road, this fellow with a windshield, you'd think he was going to a golf match or something. I mean, he stood out like a sore thumb, absolutely fatal, disorganised. They were caught within a few hours. And that was when the nightmare began. When we got back to camp at night, this Black Mariah type thing came in, it was a Gestapo. And they took these two round outside the perimeter of the camp, down into these air raids, and they beat the living daylight out. We could hear them. And I'm not ashamed to say, I was petrified. I hate violence, and, you know, I couldn't have stood punishment. I make no apologies. For a week, they battered these two, and I couldn't understand why, and I learned later. They were wanting to know where they got the civilian clothes from. And I didn't know what to do. And then one day, I saw them going to the toilet. And there were double toilets. And the guards went with them into this toilet. And I went the other side. And he started to sing. And he was talking to me through the singing, telling me not to worry that they hadn't said anything. Boy, I slept that night. I really did, because I couldn't have stood a beating up like that. I suppose I would have to, but... you know, it was a terrible worry. And they whipped them off, and that was it. We never heard of them again. Because escaping became such a habit. When men got bored, fed up on a certain commando, they would escape. And the rule was that you were never brought back to the same camp.
You went
to another camp. But it became so bad that the Germans issued a proclamation that if you were caught escaping, you were shot on sight. Now, one or two of our fellows, I understand, went shot going over the wire or under the wire. They became too bad. And by this time, the Germans were getting very jittery too, you know. And this was in the third and fourth.
So there were a number of attempts, though.
Oh, one of the best attempts I heard was by this time, winter had come in and we didn't work. we, if you want to get onto weather now, by about December the 19th, all work stopped because there was 2 metres of frost on the ground. If you know anything of Poland, it's almost like a Russian winter. Bitterly cold. And outside, the guards used to stand in these thick woolen padded boots, you know, and collars turned up and this and the other, shivering outside. That was the only time we weren't in music. That was the other side of the wire. And the guards used to go down to the town at night, you know, and they went past the checkpoint, you see, where, of course, they were all muffled up, blizzards in the center. And as they went through, they would say, good night, good, or, you know, I'll feed us in, or something like that. He said, well, lads, put his greatcoat on, muffled himself up, and walked straight out of the camp. Nobody challenged him. He didn't get far, but it was the excitement with a lot of them. But one or two left working parties, but they were quickly caught. I only heard of one who got really anywhere, any distance at all. Escape was talked about.
Did the Gestapo come in every time there was escape?
No. Well, I learned later that the Gestapo and the Wehrmacht were poles apart, you know. The Wehrmacht would deal with it if possible, but this was, civilians were concerned, you see, and that was what they were after, as far as we could see. And I tell you, it was an experience I didn't relish at all. It was very, very worrying.
With the onset of winter, how did you keep yourselves warm?
Well, you see, there is camaraderie in things. You see, we slept on bunks, you see, with about 30 bedboards, and each day one man had to volunteer to give up a bedboard. So by the spring, you had no bedboards left.
Oh, you're burning it.
Burned it. And we were allowed to go out, and we burnt what's called Brennholz. When we pulled these roots, these were all pine forests, incidentally. Oh, what we heard, one of the ironies we heard, that this huge forest, you could walk 4 days and not get out. It was a huge pine forest. Before the war, belonged to Brian May, the match people. So we heard, and how fast, John, I don't know, it seemed very ironical that Tommies were working in this place. When they pulled these roots out, underneath were these hard bits of resonant wood, and you burn like anything. Because we didn't get any coal from the Germans, or very little. So it was a matter of burning what you could. And of course, we slept most of the time. But that was the only other time I was ever punished. And I've never forgotten this. Despite the fact we packed in work about the 19th of December, and we didn't go out again until nearly into April. It was so bad. But to keep us fit, they used to take us on route marches through the town. But we had to get up early. Still early, and parade. And if we were naughty, it's no joke standing on a parade at 7 o'clock in the morning with a minus 10, and sometimes down to minus 20. And the German guards came into the camp this time to rouse us out of our beds. And if you hadn't 2 feet on the deck, you were in trouble. And I didn't get my feet down quick enough, and all they did was to whip you. You know, you very like this number, and then your name was read out, and you had to go out and parade. And I was made to stand, not only me, but anybody punished was made to stand 2 hours with their nose touching the Stacheldraht, the barbed wire. And you had to stand there motionless for 2 hours. And that, to me, was a little bit sadistic. And it was very, very trying. Minus 10, minus, it was very, very cold. And if you moved, you got another 2 hours. And that was the worst punishment I ever got in that sense. The only cheering thing was that the boys were always standing there ready, but this time we had Red Cross and a nice hot cup of tea ready for when you came back off parade. But that was the type of punishment you got.
You've talked about the friendships that grew in the camp. Were living so close to people, were there clashes?
Oh, yes. We had one fellow in the camp, I'll not mention his name, but he was a professional boxer. And he used to swagger around the camp. Funny enough, he actually came and taught me how to box, because I was always fancied myself to, you know, noble artist.
Is that why I don't want to mention his name?
Well, he could be. I doubt it. But
do you remember his name?
Parsons. Funny, I remember his name. Came from the East End of London. Quite good with his fists. But he was a bit bombastic, which was a pity, because he had a good side to him. And he clashed with this fellow out of the one of the Yorkshire regiments, real Yorkshire lad, who wore glasses, unfortunately, in that sense. And it got to a pitch that I had to settle it. So on a Sunday morning, they went down to the recreation. Nobody else, just the two of them, and they knocked the hell out of each other. And that was the end of it. And no more trouble. The Germans didn't know anything about it. But it was a bit of a vendetta.
Were there other relationship problems from time to time?
Not really. Some of them were really too funny to be considered. This is true. I've always been proud to be a Geordie, but we had two Geordies in the camp. There were a lot more, but these two were what we called muckers. You paired off, or threes, you know. It was the only way you could do it, spread your food around. And these two, when we got Red Cross, we always used to dread. This sounds funny, doesn't it? But we always used to dread that there would be an odd number of peas in a packet. That's how they shared things. One for you, one for me. We just couldn't believe it, you know. I mean, when you're mucking in, you share everything. Everything had to be down the middle. If the bread was cut to it, there used to be the most terrible arguments, and yet they were good friends. But, you know, they got on top of one another. Yes, oh yes, they were very tight, by Jove. There were little skirmishes and sometimes clash of personalities, but by and large, you had to live with one another. I was very fortunate.